What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
With us on the line is Rebecca Costa, and she has been with us in the past, and it's really a delight to have you back again. And you have got to remind us, because some people weren't listening to America Trends when you first came by, a sociobiologist. What is that again?
It's some fancy words for people who look at the evolutionary basis for why we behave the way that we do. And, of course, you know, we're a product of millions of years of evolution, and sometimes the things that we do in modern times make sense, and sometimes we can't make any sense of it. And oftentimes there's an evolutionary explanation for that, and that's what we look for.
But sometimes, you know, I look at our behaviors, though I know war is down, thank goodness. We don't have as many major conflicts as we've had in the past, but there's still so much to upset us about the human condition, the way we act and react to each other. I mean, are we really evolving, or have we evolved to a point where some of this human nature is nothing we can ultimately get out of our system in terms of some of the bad behaviors?
Some people say, well, we're so DNA driven that, you know, what's the use of it? People are going to bicker in Washington, D.C., and they're going to bicker between countries, and you can't even get husbands and wives to stay together. You know, so what's the point of it all? And, you know, there are some people that take a dark view of those things. But and Ed Wilson, I think, characterized our condition as it stands today the best. And when he said that we have Paleolithic emotions, medieval institutions, and godlike technology. and that is the, you know, that is the most succinct summation of where humanity is today that I have ever heard.
Well, we just recorded another podcast because we do a number when we get into the studio. And I want to ask you about this because I know we're talking a lot, and you do in your books, On the Verge, for example, about these weapons, as the other author and guest we had, of mass destruction. We had a woman on saying that a lot of the things that we now use to quantify behaviors and activities are actually just keeping in line with past predictors of human behavior, and we're just building in the same biases using math or a quantitative approach, and just kind of going on and repeating some of past practice. What do you think about that? Because a lot of people are talking these days about regulating these algorithms that in many ways are doing some good in our society as well.
I don't think you can regulate algorithms any more than you can regulate the use of social media. I mean, the train has left the station. You know, what are you supposed to do when you're creating as much data as we produced from the dawn of humankind to around year 2003 every 24 hours? I mean, what good is that data if you don't have ability to look at patterns within the data? So think of just billions and billions and billions of data points being produced every second of every day. It behooves us to look for patterns. And as those patterns and machine learning comes into existence, we're becoming extremely accurate predictors. Because once you know what the numbers are 1 through 100, it's not too hard to predict what the 101st number is, right? And if you have thousands of numbers, it's not hard to predict what the next number in that sequence is. So this is where we're getting. We're getting to the point where our accuracy levels are going from 80% to 85% to 90% to 99.9%, of an accurate prediction of what the next event will be in the stock market, in warfare, in violent behavior by individuals. We're getting there.
But if, in fact, we're using methodology that in the past left certain things out or was really incomplete in terms of the data, just the people we arrested, well, that doesn't include the people who we didn't arrest who kind of got away with it. Or, you know, it may be faulty data that goes into
some of this. You can't really fool machine learning. I mean, when you start to think of quantum computing and combined with artificial intelligence, it's not like trying to, you know, it's not like a teenager trying to fool their parents.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're not talking about that. We're talking about so much data that the error rates are minuscule.
Talk to us about the areas where you think this is being so effectively used that it really can avoid so many of the mistakes that decision makers have made in the past. Because right now, we still see a lot of people making bad judgments, bad decision, half the population with no money at all. I mean, why is it not perhaps showing up everywhere that this pre-adaptation that you talk about, the ability to adapt before the fact, is it only being used by certain communities or certain groups of people, and therefore it, again, is not necessarily helping everyone in our society? Explain who's benefiting most at this point from pre-adaption.
This is a complicated question that you raise because, first of all, we have to understand that government leaders always fall way behind science and technology. They're not out ahead of it. They're mm-hmm. behind it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is massively problematic. And the example I frequently give is, you know, deciding finally that there were enough accidents on the road that they had to make laws against texting and driving at the same time. So right around the time that the government gets around to saying, well, you can't text and also drive a two-ton vehicle, driverless cars come along. You know, technology solved that. You can text all you want in a driverless car.
Mm-hmm.
So our laws tend to be way behind the curveball. And so when you say, well, we've got all of this data and we've got these algorithms and we've got these predictive models, we could head off a lot of mass violence. We could head off addiction as an example. Fuzzy Logix is a company down in Atlanta that's a predictive analytics company. And they can predict whether an individual is predisposed to become an opioid addict, right, within 86 to 90% accuracy. So most people that are suffering from opioid addiction today, and I would say the vast, vast majority, got their start on a legal doctor's prescription. And then it escalated from there. But imagine if a doctor said, you know, would you like to take a questionnaire and find out if, you know, how predisposed you are genetically to become an addict to the stuff that I was going to prescribe for you? I would say yes, and the vast majority of people that are seeing a doctor would say yes. And if I found out I was in the 90 percentile of becoming an addict, the doctor would probably steer me toward a different pain management strategy, right? It's not worth the risk to take, and so, you know, but instead what happened was we didn't use the data because doctors weren't legally required to use that data. So it's shocking to people that we have that technology today. So instead what we're doing is we're spending billions of dollars trying to treat opioid addiction, which, by the way, for people that are listening, we don't have cures for addiction. I don't care what anybody says, there's no cure for addiction. We can manage it. We can give you tools to control it. We can give you alternate substances, but we can't cure you once you become an addict. It's way too late. And that's getting back to that Paleolithic instinct, right?
Mm-hmm.
We want the drugs, and we get hooked on the drugs, and then we can't ever get unhooked from the drugs. And so why not use these algorithms and all the data that we have and our ability to predict your probability of getting addicted? Why not head off the problem before it starts? That's pre-adaptation, not adapting after the fact, adapting before.
Okay, so what do you have to have in your toolbox to be able to pre-adapt? What are the mechanisms? How expensive is it? How many companies are prone to do this? Because you say we can anticipate food, rare earth mineral, oil, nursing shortages. We can figure out whether a company is going to meet their quarterly earnings. So why are there still those who are sick, those who still don't have food, and those who lose money?
Answer. You already know the answer because, and I've been quoted many times as saying this, and I can take credit for this one saying. I can't take credit for what Ed Wilson has said or what Einstein has said, but this one thing I can, and that is that the opposite of science is politics. The reason that we don't have, right, and are not using science to guide public policy is because of politics. Not because of the lack of data, not because we couldn't head off problems ahead of time. It's because of politics. And that's where those Paleolithic emotions come in. I mean, look at Washington, D.C. It's very tribal. It's one tribe fighting the other tribe, no matter what they do or say. To that, I spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C., let me tell you, I am a data wonk. I can lay out facts and charts and spreadsheets and show people exactly what's going to happen if they continue down that path, and everyone's eyes roll over, you know, unless there's a political upside to it, nobody's interested.
A couple of planes just came out of the sky and killed lots of people. And, of course, we find out that perhaps Boeing is self-regulating and the FAA was aware of this, or maybe they had the greatest experts. But when we see that, tell us what we should learn from that as it relates to avoiding that going forward.
Well, the real tragedy here is that of all the predictive modeling tools we have, engineering is where much of these predictive models started. And so they're very sophisticated. You do know we don't actually need to create cars and put crash dummies in them and run them into a wall, right? I mean, we used to have to do that, create these products and then crash them and destroy them to see where the weaknesses were and where the dangers were. But now we have things like finite element modeling and analysis and stress testing that can be all done on a computer much more accurately. And so overall, products have become much more safer. If you think about, you know, the dangerous kinds of lawn darts and things like that that we were playing with when we were all kids, you know. But now these analysis tools allow us to head off danger way beforehand. So this is a particular tragedy where Boeing is concerned, because I am absolutely convinced that there's a lawsuit in the making here of horrendous proportions, because these problems could have been analyzed and sorted out beforehand.
Some say
this is a case where this plane was not properly QA'd. Now, there could be a lot of reasons for that. There could be financial pressure to get a product out the door. There could be political lowering of the bar, right, in terms of the testing that the FAA and others did. We don't really know what it was, but I guarantee you whatever the problem was, it was not because of lack of tools, technological tools to head this problem off.
Some say that we're 15, 20, 30 years from really seeing the true impacts, though we've already begun to see them, of climate change. Can we reverse it? What do we know about this problem that we are told is global, that its impact is going to be severe throughout the world? And are we going to be in time to pre-adapt to the change that we have already begun to see?
I don't think anybody with any credentials can answer that question. I mean, they might be able to answer it, but what they tell you is just not going to be factual. We don't know is the answer. The big political aspect of climate change, and I don't know why it's a political issue at all. It should just be a scientific issue, but it's become a political football. And the big question now is, how much is human activity affecting climate change? Or is this just a natural phenomena? And, you know, as a scientist, when we don't know the answer to something, I always err on the cautious side, particularly if there's potential to completely decimate the environment on which humans rely on to live. I think when it comes to something like that, you should err on the positive side. Like, let's just assume, instead of proving, let's just assume that human activity is contributing, and there are things that humans could do, right, to moderate that. I would be all for that. But I think what happens is that people take extreme positions, and the extreme position that they took initially was humans are the cause. Well, let me tell you, that wasn't established, not when they said it and not now. Proving causation is extremely difficult on something as complex as climate change because we don't have a lot of data. We have a lot of, you know, archaeological stuff and geographic stuff, geological stuff, but we don't know for a fact how climate change occurs, and we haven't been collecting data long enough. And by long enough, I mean for millions and millions of years to be able to determine human activity is causal. But there's a high likelihood, and I think people who are climate deniers would give me this, there's a high likelihood that we probably contribute in some way. You know, and let's just say some way instead of saying it's carbon dioxide or it's whatever people want to attribute it to. I would just say better to err on the positive side and say, you know what, if there's any chance that human activity is accelerating it, we should just try to govern that and moderate that. And that to me seems like a good judgment call. Where your life is concerned, you don't take risk.
Do we have
it's as simple as that.
Do we have the technology to do that? Are you as worried as some that there's no will, political and otherwise, to really attack this worldwide?
Well, that shouldn't surprise anybody. There's no will to attack anything. I mean, it's just not limited to climate change, you know? I mean, we need a different type of leadership. And that leadership needs to come, unfortunately, from science. It needs to be science-based. We need one politician to run for office that is a science and a data wonk and who says, you know what, I don't have a bone to pick with the left or the right. I'm just going to give you, the American people, the data on which I'm basing my decision. I'm sorry that some people don't like it, but these are the facts. And you know, they're inconvenient, as Al Gore once said. You know,
but I read that there were only about two or three scientists in Congress. I don't know if more of them ran this last cycle, but very few people have a scientific background, and you can tell that whenever there's some person of science in front of them.
You got that right. We have, think about this, just from a logical standpoint, right? Think about this. We have people in Washington, D.C. making decisions about nuclear power policy that have never taken a physics class in their entire life. They are lawyers and they are politicians. And what do lawyers do? They're paid to debate. They're paid to win an argument. And so now you've got two tribes of professional arguers. and this is what happens. Nobody cares about the science. Nobody cares about the data. And so public policy is completely irrational and too late to the table. And this is a problem for me as a scientist. We have to infuse science and data-based policy. And if we don't get on board on that, then we're just going to continue to see all this data go to waste in terms of our leadership.
There can be no greater advantage, you write, than certainty of the future, not in nature, not in business, not in governance. Okay, governance, we know, forget about that. But in business, now, in 2008, 2009, we had the terrible crash, and that was global. Lots of people don't recognize that. It wasn't only left to the United States. How could so much quantitative material be so badly utilized and in many ways fudged in terms of AAA ratings and such? I mean, that we all went into the drink with that, when in fact you're suggesting in some of the things that you have said or written that we should be able to know whether a company is going to meet their quarterly earnings, whether in fact we should have confidence in various companies and stocks. But yet we continue to have these cycles, and people tell us, We're always going to have these cycles. And yet this is probably some of the most math-driven stuff you can imagine, because a company's performance is based on so many factors that are quantifiable.
Well, that's exactly the point. We didn't all go in the drink. There were some people who actually looked at the mathematics and actually used the data, and they got out of the market, and they did well. It's the politicians who created a, you know, false subprime mortgage strategy that over-leveraged financial institutions and caused, not just in the United States, but caused a domino effect on a global basis, that were ignoring the data. That's how that happened. It wasn't that the data wasn't there. It wasn't that they didn't know. They knew.
Now
and so did the financial institutions. They knew they were making faulty subprime loans, but the government was saying do it, so they did. They were completely unregulated, and this is what happened. But everybody didn't go down the drink. The vast majority, unfortunately, on Main Street, took the brunt of it. But the financial institutions, they made money. They did well.
Yeah, well, in the end, many
in
of them
the end
did, yeah.
They did well because they had more data than the average citizen. So again, you know, you can say, well, you know, why didn't our leaders know this was going to happen? It's because they're not data based.
So as we're looking at data, what do you think it is going to be best used to do to help us, you know, make this world a better world, more predictive of what it is that we need and all of the possibilities for all of us? I mean, what are you most hopeful? Because you are a very hopeful person, and you do like to look forward with anticipation and excitement about what's ahead. And you think that, you know, the science and technology is there for us to use for these purposes. Where do you think we're going to see its application most beneficially used in the coming period?
Well, we have to remember that he who has the information has the upper hand. And as data becomes more and more available, right? I mean, now you can walk into your house and ask Alexa what the weather is like in Timbuktu, and she'll tell you, right? So as the data gets out to people, and folks like the Googles of the world provide more and more accurate background analytics, it becomes a bit of a leveling of the playing field, where nobody knows more about the future than anybody else. But it's going to take a while, and during that interim period, those who have quantum computers and have very sophisticated algorithms are going to behave in a very predatory way. There's going to be kind of an ugly in-between before that data is available to everyone.
Mm.
And in the same way that when the Internet first came out, we didn't all have access to it, but the financial community did, and large corporations that could create hermetically sealed rooms with massive computers had the upper hand. And we on the street did not. But then suddenly mobile phones come out, new apps, and Wi-Fi is everywhere. And so, you know, you don't need those hermetically sealed rooms anymore. And so they don't have the upper hand. Well, guess what? Business is going to have the upper hand again, because they're moving forward already rapidly with predictive analytics and very, very sophisticated computing that we don't really have access to. So there's a bit of a predatory period that we're passing through right now, and it's unfortunate, but that's really how technology evolves and finally gets to Main Street. When it does get to Main Street, nobody will have the upper hand.
And how long a period do you expect we are going to see this predatory activity because of that imbalance in terms of who has the information and not? What kind of time frame are we talking about?
I'm not very good at calling out those kinds of time frames. You know, I mean, I'd be taking a guess at best and say about 5 or 10 years it's going to get very predatory on Wall Street. The financial institutions will know much more than the investors. and they will see problems coming. You can already sort of detect it right now. You get a lot of financial gurus talking about a recession headed our way, and you're seeing CD rates drop for long-term investment versus short-term. I mean, on a short-term CD, I don't know, 8 months or so, you might be able to get 2.5%. You go out to a year or 2 years, and it's 2.3% or 2.1%. So that's there's some rough indicators, right, that we can look at right now that are sort of traditional indicators but have gotten more a little more accurate and sophisticated. But the financial institutions, make no mistake, that the guys on Wall Street, they know exactly what's going to happen.
When we look at just the basics of life on Earth in terms of a pre-adaptation and the ability for us to take a lot of what we know and a lot of what we are capable of affecting and making it positive for so many more people around the world, when we look at food, shelter, life expectancy, do you think that they're all going to be on a really good trajectory over the long sweep of time based upon these tools that we have access to now?
Well, again, we're going to go through a little bit of a dip, a backwards, where mortality rates will go up, lifespan will probably dip down a little bit. We're going to see a backward motion that will be for a very short period of time. After which, then the correction, the positive correction, will be much more extreme. So I predict it'll be a little bit of a bumpy road in the transition. But, you know, the last time we spoke, I gave an example that I'd like to give to the listeners today. Sure. As well as an example of what I mean about it. Right now, if you trip and fall and you're an elderly senior, it usually means you can't live independently anymore. It's usually you'll break your hip or your leg and suddenly you're in assisted living, and then, you know, that's kind of how you end out your life. But it turns out we've now discovered, thanks to data, science, and algorithms, we've now discovered that there's a change in your normal walking gait of somewhere between 2 and 3 centimeters. It's indiscernible by the eye. And so there are makers that are making little cuffs for your ankles that are similar to a Fitbit that can detect a change in your normal everyday walking gait and alert your cell phone and say, hey, you're getting ready to take a fall. Because now what we now know is if that walking gait changes, that you have an 86% chance of tripping and falling within a 3-week period of time. Now imagine what that means to the elderly, to actually be able to prevent a fall within 3 weeks.
Yeah, I mean, it's all so amazing and potentially so game-changing, but we still kind of get up and do the same things we've always done. But I do look forward to the future, and there's nobody who can better forecast and help us to understand what some of these remarkable changes are going to look like and how we can pre-adapt toward them than you, Rebecca Costa. What is it that you're working on now that you'd like to tell us about? I mean, you've written so many wonderful books, you know, The Watchman's Rattle and On the Verge. What are you working on now?
Well, I wasn't going to talk about it, but I'll give you a little preview. I recently became very interested in what the algorithm for human happiness might be.
Wow.
And this seemed like the biggest question of all, because what do all humans want? They want to be happy. But it turns out that, you know, at a certain threshold, money doesn't really incrementally add to your happiness. And it turns out that certain disasters and horrible things that happen in life don't necessarily mean that the people that experience those won't be happy the rest of their life. And so it's a mysterious algorithm with a lot of factors. And I came across a research paper where they studied monozygotic twins that were separated at birth, and found that they had self-reported happiness on a daily basis. And it turns out that these studies were launched by many, many countries, and it turns out that up to 60% of your happiness, your day-to-day happiness and contentment and well-being that you feel in life, is genetic.
Hmm.
It's genetically imposed. So that raised the question, well, what's the other 30 and 40% based on? And so now I've been culling through research dating back to the 1940s by economists and biologists and social psychologists, going through and looking at the empirical data to try to nail down what happens when you choose A over B or B over A. Exactly how much does it raise your odds of being happy, and how much does it depress your odds? And I'm trying to come up with a rough algorithm on what actually constitutes, what choices you can make that will constitute greater probabilities of happiness and lower probabilities of happiness.
Fascinating. Your work is remarkable. This is Rebecca Costa, a world-renowned sociobiologist and futurist. And again, pick up anything that she has written. She writes extensively online as well. Rebecca, lead us to all that material, if you will.
Well, the best thing is to just go to my website, which is RebeccaCosta.com. That's RebeccaCosta.com.
I can't thank you enough for coming back to America Trends. It's always a delight and always a revelation. Thanks again for being with us today, okay?
Thank you, Larry.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.